Cats in Hell, a look back at Saturday Night Live with your hosts, Matt and Keith. Brought to you by Lion's Den Audio Theater. Like and subscribe to Lion's Den Audio Theater for more Lion's Den goodness. And here are your hosts, Keith and Matt.
Saturday Night Live, Season 4, Episode 4, starring Steve Martin. Originally aired on November 4th, 1978. Welcome to SN Hell. My name is Keith. With me, as always, my good buddy Matt. Hello, Matt. How you holding up tonight, brother?
I'm pretty good, thanks. How are you?
Awesome. I'm doing well. I'm doing really well. With us tonight for the very first time, a new third chair. We've been in negotiations for months now. It's Harris. Hello, Harris. How you doing?
I'm fantastic, Keith. How are you?
Doing really well. Matt and I have been talking, and Matt said that you have a lot of appreciation for Saturday Night Live, the show. Tell me about, broad question here, but tell me about your fandom.
I've been watching it as far back as I can remember. I'm still a current watcher. Like, I watch week to week. So, I mean, I remember really fondly back mid-80s, when I started watching it regularly week to week.
Nice.
And I've rarely missed an episode.
Oh, that's awesome. So, you know, Matt and I both sort of started our casual viewing as youngsters. We're talking the Nora Dunn, Jan Hooks, Dennis Miller era. Is that around your area or was it a little later?
Definitely.
Okay, cool. No,
definitely right around that time.
Yeah. I mean, Dennis Miller was... People find it hard to believe, but he was a superstar on that desk when he was there.
He was a rock star.
Yeah, yeah. You know, when you were watching early on, surely to God, somebody said to you, this is good, but the early cast was better. What are your thoughts on the original cast? And well, really, I guess with the cast we're seeing tonight with Chevy out and Bill in.
I think maybe I'd liken it to the James Bond scenario where I think your first James Bond is your James Bond.
Yeah.
And I think it might be the same with SNL casts. I think I think that like a current generation would not appreciate the original cast nearly as much. Mm-hmm. And I love them, obviously. Yeah. Like I grew up, I mean, Caddyshack is one of my, I saw it way too young movies that I just was obsessed with.
Yeah.
So I definitely appreciate the original cast, but I mean, I also love, you know, some of the 80s cast. I love some of the current cast members. I think Will Ferrell might be one of the greatest cast members in history.
Oh, agreed. Yeah. Yeah. Every cast has their shining stars and their shining sketches. I agree. I mean, if you're to really pick the best of all time, you're not going to pick from any one cast, I don't think.
It's hard because the original cast, I mean, there's no lemons in that group. There's just zero. They're all superstars.
Yeah.
Yep. Which is not the same in other seasons, but and I mean, it's certainly the episode we're about to talk about tonight. I mean, they spread everything out very evenly amongst the cast, which is very interesting, which they don't do anymore. Like, they definitely favor certain people.
Yeah, a great point. Yeah, actually, I have that written down later about the casting choices for tonight. Tonight, we have Steve Martin back for number 6. He's again tying Buck Henry for the most prolific host. That record will not last super long, but he will eventually, of course, overtake Buck Henry. Any thoughts about Steve Martin as a host from both of you? As I know, Matt, we've had some ups and downs with Steve, but it's been all ups lately. And Harris, of course, are you one of the many, like Matt and I, who just as a child thought Steve Martin was a cast member?
You know, gun to my head, I might have, in a trivia question, I might have guessed that he was a cast member at one point.
I don't get me wrong, I like him and he's funny, but I also feel like we've seen him a lot.
Yeah, unlike Buck's, where he's relatively spread out, Steve has kind of been clumped together, hasn't he?
Yeah, and they all feel pretty frequent, and he even references February in this episode. I don't know if it was legitimate or not, but it didn't seem like a joke. That's coming up pretty soon, if that's accurate. Is that accurate?
It was the plan, but it doesn't happen. No, he doesn't.
Oh, okay. There you go.
So we're going to go right to our cold open, if that's all right, fellas.
Let's do it.
So we start with Dan as Jimmy Carter, and he's coming to us from the Oval Office, and he's addressing the inflation situation in the United States. He says that the U.S. economy is screwed, glued, and tattooed. Carter tells folks that the only way they can get through this tragedy is to think of inflation as their friend. And he says that the average blue-collar job in 2000 will be over $500,000 a year. And therefore, most Americans will be millionaires and will feel like big shots. Tax rebates will then go to the most deserving. But it's going to cost a lot of money to do that, so they're going to print more money, which will cause more inflation. And that's okay, because almost everyone will be a millionaire. I thought this was an excellent cold open. It's Dan's Jimmy Carter. Never been better. The real Jimmy Carter had some real struggles, some that were, you know, out of his control. And his personality wasn't one to sound the alarm or really get angry, but to try to remain optimistic. And Dan really captures that here. That same optimism probably cost him his job in 1980. What's really poignant to me about this sketch is how today is very similar to what Carter was talking about here. And, you know, we're living in a world that's struggling with the same problems. And it's also a world that's sort of a victim of how these problems were and weren't dealt with at the time. Kind of an offshoot of this sketch. You know, I've heard similar arguments about economic policy from folks that are seeking office, you know, recent or were seeking office recently. I mean, certainly not as blatant and ridiculous, but still pretty damn close. I thought this was one of the best cold opens we've had in a long time.
I completely agree. I think the printing more money thing is, I mean, I laughed, genuinely laughed out loud at the concept. I loved his impression. I thought it was great. I thought it was great that he didn't really look too much like Jimmy Carter, but boy, he had the dialect down and the cadence down perfectly. And yeah, it couldn't be more prescient. We're literally going through this today.
That'd be 3 for 3 for us fellas. Thought his bad ideas were really funny. Hi, this is Jimmy. Roll off more of those 20s. Flash that Carter smile. The only thing I don't know how you guys feel, but I always find it fun. I feel like, Keith, you're going to disagree, but I kind of like when they break character a little bit to yell that line live from New York with a little more energy.
No, I like that. I like that very much. Yeah. I think certain people overdo it.
I prefer the staying in character. I think it's neat, cool when they do it in character.
I don't know, because I am thinking of instances where people did break character and it doesn't work. Well, you're both right, really. I liked when Farrell as Bush didn't break character. That's the one that's jumping up at me right away. But anyway.
Yeah, that's pretty funny. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're now at the intro. Harris, a lot of changes with these intros over the years, but they always have a similar vibe. How iconic are the intros?
Well, I love it. I never skip it, ever. It's part of the ritual for me. So, yeah, I really like it. I love the cast portraits. Very weird to sort of, you know, starring Steve Martin and da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
That caught me a little bit off guard. I wasn't expecting that. And I've seen some of the early episodes. I just don't recall that.
Yeah, because modern day, it's flipped, isn't it? The host is at the end.
Very much.
Yeah. That's even going back 20 years now that I think about it, like, or even 30 years. We're now with the monologue. Steve Martin comes down the steps. He has a vice on his head. He said he isn't feeling very well due to a splitting headache, and it feels as if his head was in a vice. He is completely unaware that he actually has a vice on his head. The headache has remained despite the fact he's taken some aspirins. Someone in the audience tells him he has a clamp on his head. Steve laughs because nobody at the show said a word about it. Not the makeup, not the cast, not the costumes. Then he does bits about being on drugs. He does a funny bit about smoking weed periodically throughout the afternoon, and it turns into the evening, the day, the morning, etc. He quit all drugs, but he had a sore ankle. So now he's taking something from his doctor, and he's high as a kite. And he tells everyone to take these crazy drugs he's on that are called placebos. He then refers to his last appearance where he did the pickpocket thing with Bill Murray and calls Bill Murray out, and they start to do this sort of Pavlovian thing where every time Bill Murray does what Steve Martin asks him to, Martin gives Murray a cookie. And some of them things include just basic handshakes or playing Mary Had a Little Lamb on some horns. Then Martin gets Murray to jump through a flaming hoop, and Martin does not give him a cracker. Bill gets very unsettled about this and threatens Steve that he will tell the rest of the cast that they're not going to get crackers for performing tonight. Steve then panics and says that giving a cracker to everyone after each segment is going to change things financially for him. Pretty good monologue. What really kind of floored me is, like, here we are 45 years later. Kind of goes to show you the timelessness of these two performers.
It was too long, but when Bill came in, it was pretty uphill from there. I really liked Bill in it, and when he was kind of standing up for his cracker and getting defiant, I thought that was really funny. It took forever to get there, though. And I didn't like the stand up off the top.
I thought it was pretty good. I thought it was, I completely agree, a little bit too long. I'm a huge fan of not obviously reading cue cards. And Steve seems so at ease and so relaxed and comfortable with what he's doing that it just looks like he's just coming up with it all off the top of his head. And I think that's incredible, especially with newer hosts, you just never see that. It's literally just normally just reading. His sort of affected voice is a little strange. And I thought Bill Murray was hilarious. I thought the whole dog reward thing was very funny, like literally jumping through a flaming hoop. I thought there was some real weird prop use for the monologue.
When he lit that on fire, I was kind of like, whoa, you know?
Yeah.
We now go to a commercial, and it's a concert tour by Elvis Presley's Coat. And this was written by Mr. Bill's Walter Williams, actually. It's advertising a concert series featuring Elvis's coat on stage. It's an actual coat owned by Elvis that pretty much sits there as Elvis's music plays. We hear crowds cheering. Then we have some sidewalk testimonials from folks who saw the show. Neat little bit at the end, Yvonne Hudson, who would go on to be a feature player a little bit later, is there at the end. This was very real. These commercials advertising concerts and tribute acts and even like hypnotists like Ravine and stuff were everywhere when I was a kid. This commercial was exactly like those. And the thing that really got me is that I think Elvis's coat would have outsold a lot of those live acts that did come through Eastern Canada touring at the time. I really, really, really liked this. This was one of the best commercials I think I've seen due to its silliness and its realism.
I adored the skit. I loved it. Loved every single second of it. That's my sense of humor in a nutshell. Just really weird, really avant-garde. Absolutely. I was laughing out loud the entire time. I thought it was very clever. Really well done.
I thought it was super smart. When they were making the jacket boogie around and it had a lay on, it was, laugh out loud funny.
We're now off to What If, these all written by Jim Downey. It's, I think, the third, maybe the fourth in a continuing series. We have Steve as Craig Blair hosting this time. The show deals with hypothetical questions from viewers. And the question that was sent in for this week is, what if Eleanor Roosevelt could fly? And the panel features Lorraine as Sylvia Reed, who is an authority on first ladies, and George Temple, an aviation expert from Lockheed, that's played by Garrett. So Sylvia Reed, Lorraine, says that Eleanor Roosevelt was the most outstanding first lady, but none could fly. Chester A. Arthur's wife was, however, a good long jumper. She thinks that Eleanor Roosevelt could have made the best of the skills compared to any other first lady. Garrett is asked about the military significance of a flying first lady during World War II. He then says that several elderly ladies were tested in wind tunnels at Lockheed, and they were unwieldy, and they couldn't pack a payload. And the benefits of a flying first lady would be merely symbolic. They then go to a dramatization of what it might have been like if Eleanor Roosevelt could fly. So we see John as FDR, and that's the first time we see anyone playing that president, and Jane as Eleanor Roosevelt. FDR thinks that Eleanor shouldn't fly, but she thinks it will, if it could shorten the war by one day, she should do it. He advises her not to wear a skirt, by the way, and says she should wear some pants if she's going to fly above the soldiers. Jane puts on some giant aviator goggles and flies away. We get some cuts to Jane as Eleanor Roosevelt in front of a green screen flying with a bunch of U.S. bombers and waving them on until poor Eleanor is shot down. We then go back to the panel, and Garrett says Eleanor Roosevelt was actually vulnerable because she was wearing clothing instead of armor. And Lorraine says if Eleanor Roosevelt could fly and was shot down, FDR would have married his mistress, Lucy Mercer, and spent less time winning the war. And then they talk a bit about last week's episode about Charlemagne finding a 1977 almanac. And the panel agrees that no one would have believed him. This was a very good sketch. The studio bits with the panel were good, but the real stars of this sketch are Jane and John as the Roosevelts. I thought both nailed it, especially Jane as Eleanor. I thought it was hilarious. Jane flying with the bombers in front of the green screen got one of the biggest laughs I've ever given the show. The whole idea of her being able to fly, and the whole idea of this TV show, What If, even existing, is so awesome for me. They also, the bits about the cloth skirt instead of Eleanor wearing armor, just too silly for me not to love. Another big thumbs up for me.
Keith, I think you might actually disinvite me from the show going forward, because I didn't find this skit funny at all. It just, it did not land with me whatsoever. I thought Jane Curtin was great as Eleanor, and John was good as FDR. I just didn't laugh. Like, it's the classic, you know, judging a comedy. Like, do you laugh or did you not laugh? Like, yeah. I can appreciate it. I just didn't find it funny at all.
Understood.
The image of Jane flying, yeah, that was really funny. But otherwise, I really thought it was boring. I didn't appreciate that style of silly, I guess. I thought it was kind of academic, and I just didn't like the look of it. I didn't like the cut of its jib. I thought it was a dud.
We are now off to Theodoric of York, Medieval Judge. This is, of course, a follow-up to last year's Theodoric of York, Medieval Barber. Starts with a great bit where a bunch of people are gathered in a courtroom, a medieval courtroom, and they're going to lynch Lorraine's character. And Theodoric says, "We're not barbarians. This is the 12th century. Love it. So everyone in the courtroom is claiming that Lorraine's character was consorting with the devil. Gilda, returning as Brunegilda, is accusing Lorraine of chatting with a leather-winged griffin, which Theodoric, played by Steve, of course, deems was the devil. Theodoric says the only way to find out if Lorraine is guilty or not is to throw her in the trough of justice. So they throw Lorraine in a big tub, and when the character drowns, she's deemed not guilty. Phil then comes in as a version of his Honker character, who was a slave being charged with escaping and stealing a pig. And he has the pig under his arm. The pig is quite loud and obnoxious. His claim is that the pig was a gift and he is a free man. So he is sentenced to walk across some hot coals, the hot coals of truth. And when he screams in pain, it's tantamount to admitting his guilt. Bill is then put on the torture rack. Belushi saunters in as John the Tanner, who had his right arm cut off for theft, his tongue cut out for lying, and now he's up for adultery. And there's a bit of funniness about Theo telling John the Tanner what the punishment is for adultery. Jane then enters as Lorraine's character's mom and wonders where she is. Theodoric tells her she's at the bottom of the trough of justice, therefore meaning she's not guilty, and Jane slams him for all his stupid ideals and basically killing an innocent woman. Steve then questions the notion of following the rules of the king, and he talks loud about implementing a system where people are free from cruel and unusual punishment, treated fair and equally, and tried by a jury of their peers. He does a bit where he plays with the exact number that will sit on a jury. Thinking it over, he then says, nah. Things are going to continue on as they are. Again, another excellent Theodoric sketch written by Tom Davis, by the way. It certainly isn't as good as the first one, but it is still excellent. You know, bear in mind, the first one was my favorite sketch from last year. This it's well written. Production values are through the roof. Cast are great, and into it, they're hamming it up, but they're still getting everything across. And, you know, the overall point is, no matter how far advanced we think we are as a society, there's something about accepted behaviors in our culture today, as woke as we try to be, that future generations will be so very ashamed of. And I think the Theodoric sketches bring that out so well. Bit of trivia for this one. Lorraine almost drowned during dress rehearsal when she was thrown in the trough. So lot to unpack, fellas. What do you got?
What's with the special effects tonight? We got the ring of fire, a live pig, and like the shirt getting dropped in the water. Yeah. Seems to be a lot going on. Must have been a busy week. I was surprised when they just dropped her in the water. I was like, holy shit. They really did just drop her in the water like that. And she almost drowned in dress rehearsal.
Dress rehearsal, she almost drowned, yeah.
Holy shit. Really taking a chance with that live pig that really wanted to get out of there, eh? When he passed him.
Yeah.
It was ready. I like this. Okay. I thought it was too long. Definitely not as good as the first one, but you know, I can't help but laugh at the bottom of the trough of justice. That's just a funny thing to say, but I did think it was very long. And this, you know, the, having the live pig and her dropping her in the water, I kept me excited at least watching it. It was titillating.
Yeah, I felt the same way. I felt it was very a very lively sketch, which is always nice to see. And Bill Murray doing his definitely his character that became Carl from Caddyshack, I'm sure.
Yeah,
And I thought Gilda was really fun. I thought she was really energetic and fun. And they all, the cast is so good. Like, they're just, they all seem to really want to play in this one. Can I point something out so far that we've not really talked too much about Steve Martin?
Absolutely.
Any of these sketches we've talked about so far. This seems like the cast is really outshining the host.
Yeah. I think for some of it too, like with Matt and I, the novelty of Steve Martin as a host is not so much there. We've seen him so much recently. In Theodoric might be slightly different because his mastery of language is so good in it. But he is basically setting them up and letting the cast knock them down, right?
Yeah.
Is that what you want your host to do?
So it depends on the host, I think.
I guess, but is that what you want Steve Martin to do?
Like, I think it should be almost the flip side, where it's the cast should be teeing up the host to look good.
Yeah.
I don't know. The rules are almost different for Steve Martin. I know we've had hosts that were carried by the cast. I don't know. Maybe he's too close to the show, but you're making a valid point for sure.
And I think this isn't a result of him being there too much.
We're now off to Wavelength, and this is the first musical performance of the night. It's Van Morrison, Irishman, who cut his teeth in the show band world, which was a huge thing in Ireland at the time. He became known as the lead singer for the band Them. 1967's Brown Eyed Girl made him a bit of a superstar, and it's still played everywhere today. Moon Dance in 1977 was a bit more of a gradual hit. I think it's probably more popular today than it was at the time. Van Morrison had released Wavelength in October of 78. The album was brand new, hot off the presses. It would go gold and become his fastest selling album, peaking at 28 on the Billboard charts. The single Wavelength that we hear here is number 42 on the charts. So before we get into the performance, what's your opinion of Van Morrison, fellas?
He's really not my thing. Mm-hmm. I respect, I understand. And I will say I enjoyed both musical performances quite a bit on this episode. He was never somebody whose music I really listened to. Brown Eyed Girl annoys me to this day. But I will say I think he's a fantastic singer. He didn't seem super enthused to be there. But I thought he sang very, very well. I thought the band was great.
Oh, yeah. I don't like Van Morrison. No. I find Van Morrison looks and sounds perpetually drunk. He's like a walking Irish stereotype. I really liked the look of the big wide stage, by the way. I just find Van Morrison very yelly. I might like this song without Van Morrison singing it. I'm okay with a little poppy 70s organ and, you know, that late 70s top 40 vibe, but it's too long. Everything feels a little long tonight.
So the performance, I was worried when it started that this was going to be a slow and lazy thing, but the pace picked up and I thought it was actually a tremendous performance. All the stuff that you said, Matt, about him not looking, or Harris not looking enthused to be there, are certainly true. He does have a unique and powerful voice that I do sort of enjoy, despite the fact that, like, I'm a lyrics guy. And I couldn't really make out the lyrics very well. But the energy in his band and those backup singers and the musicians really put this over for me, in the sense that I thought this was a very enjoyable performance, but I might have to go back and find out what he was singing about. We're now off to Weekend Update. So I'm going to pause here for a second. Harris, Weekend Update, do you have a favorite anchor person?
It is so hard. It's so hard to say because it's just everybody brings something different. Like, I loved 80% of Norm Macdonald. I loved it. I think he might have been most entertaining or certainly awkward. Mm-hmm. And he just never knew what he was going to say. So he was exciting. Colin Quinn was mostly terrible, but also very exciting at times.
Yep.
But yeah, I also love that the two current guys, Colin Jost and Michael Che, I think are hysterical. And they started off literally as unwatchably bad.
Yes, they did.
The first whole season that they were on was almost unwatchable, how bad their chemistry was and how bad their delivery was. And then they settled in and now they just thrive. It's crazy to watch.
Yeah, they've come a long way. We get Jane starting talking about the new Vietnamese flu shot, and it's that famous image of Nguyen Van Lem's public execution. This episode is brought to us by Colonel Lingus Fried Chicken, Southern fried chicken that takes a licking. I got to stop here, guys. One of the most popular sketches from Tina Fey's era is the Colonel Angus one. I can't help but think this was the inspiration and possibly kind of ripped off here. because I find it hard to believe as head writer that Tina Fey, who is very, very conscientious about her job, I find it hard to believe she didn't go back and watch a bit. If the case, does that lessen the impact of that Colonel Angus sketch?
Doesn't lessen it at all, but she totally saw it.
100% ripped it off in every way, and I think improved it, obviously. But
sometimes you'll see these little throwaways that go on to be something big. It's almost like if Bill Murray did a speech about how much he liked the cowbell, Don't Fear the Reaper, you know, it's like, wait a second here. All right, let's jump back here to, I'll go through some highlights for me. Jane announced that John Paul II is still alive. He has now surpassed John Paul I. We go to Celebrity Corner, and it's Garrett as Diana Ross talking to Bill about her role as Dorothy in The Wiz. She says she's done it for the money. Bill has no idea why Ross keeps pining to go back to Harlem, where he finds it poor with expensive drugs, and just can't figure out why her character would want to go back there. Bill then makes comparisons of The Wiz to Wizard of Oz and asks Diana to sing Somewhere Over the Rainbow. He then makes a joke about getting down on his knees, if you know what I mean. Diana starts singing it. Bill tears up and sings the final bit with her. When it cuts back to Jane, she looks horrified by Bill's lack of professionalism. White mice get arrested twice as often when they're consuming angel dust. Bill does his impression of an Iranian revolutionary wearing a piece of paper with holes cut out for the eyes and mouth. But he also, in this bad Middle Eastern impression he's using, he throws in the term knuckleheads a bit. Jane talks about functional literacy. And while she's talking about supporting folks and putting things in place to help them, there is a chyron saying quite the opposite. And it's from an organization called Kill the Illiterates. And it also says if anyone is watching and reading the chyron with an illiterate friend there, they're to tell the curious illiterate friend that the chyron is about M&Ms. John Belushi comes out for a political commentary. And there's a weird quick shot of a chyron in there. But he goes on to begin very calmly to talk about when and how to vote. This turns into a critical knock at people who don't vote because they just seem lazy. He then talks about his friend Steve Bouchakis, who doesn't vote, which is a shame because it's politicians who have the power to legalize drugs. He said he'd like to be out smoking hash on the street, and that's allowed in Amsterdam thanks to politicians. Jane, of course, tries to cut him off a few times. Belushi says he's been to communist countries like Mexico and Canada, and they'd love to be able to vote. And this turns into a bit about speaking and reading Mongolian and smoking Mongolian hash. This weekend update, I really liked it. The jokes were about 50-50. The segments I enjoyed. I thought this was one of Belushi's better commentaries at the desk. I thought it was funny. I loved him talking about the Mongolian hash. Jane was really good in this one. And I think a lot of the beauty of Jane is how well she delivers these stories, whether they're, you know, kind of serious with a weird twist, or there's something absolutely ridiculous, or there's something completely disgusting like that shot at the beginning of the Vietnamese execution. This was a very strong update, maybe not as good as last week, but still pretty good. Garrett, I thought, was great in the Diana Ross thing, too.
Well, I enjoyed Garrett as Diana Ross quite a bit. I was completely not expecting that. I thought Belushi was good, you know, starting off mild, then yelling, then going insane, and the falling. Showing how Canada is a communist country was very funny. But overall, I didn't laugh that much, unfortunately. I didn't, just didn't hit me.
Well, yeah, this wasn't my favorite weekend update. Oh, no. The flu shot joke was fucking dark. Of course, I noticed Colonel Angus. I continue to like Bill better, though, now that he's not doing that character. I'm still in the early stages of appreciating that. I thought I always get ripped off every time I go to Harlem was a good little part. Open up those pipes and let out that bubbling brown sugar. It's great. Jane's expression fucking made me laugh more than once in the sketch. She's so good at this. She's so good at Weekend Update. Any idiot can call 411. There was some good bits in there. It kind of took a while. This is as much as I've ever enjoyed Belushi. I like when the rage builds up slowly but surely, like he's in Falling Down or something, and it just bubbles over. And Jane's like really worried look and trying to simmer him down. There was some jokes I didn't like. I didn't like that bit about the crawl bit about literacy.
We're now off to the Festrunk brothers. You're getting a good meal deal tonight of characters there, Harris. You're getting a good bunch.
Yeah.
So Jane, Gilda, and Lorraine go to a bar. They see Ted the bartender, played by Bill Murray. When they sidle up to the bar to get a drink, John comes over as Glenn Johnson, and he tries to buy the girls a drink using a line about using up the money in his expense account. Then we see Georg and Yortok Festrunk enter. They've been all over town looking for foxes, but all the foxes are scared of their large bulges. The brothers then show the bartender their toiletry bag for spending the night. They then approach the three women and start propositioning them. John comes over to rescue the girls. Look like there might be a scrap there until Bill's character Ted kicks John out. They then show the girls a vibrating machine for sex that they've brought from Czechoslovakia. And it's basically a cordless drill with a feather dust. I really enjoyed this. It's not the best Fest Drunks for me, but it was probably second best. What's really great about these sketches to me is that, I mean, the performances are top notch. The costumes are top notch. Even the set in this one was fantastic. The girls' lack of interest in them was palpable. But I kind of realized it now that what I really like is how the guys have this need to explain the step they're on in the courting ritual. Like, it's now time to start a swinging rap session. And really, like, these guys are not that much different from most men and women who are, at least in my day, were out at the bars trying to pick up. The difference is these guys say what they think rather than just think it.
Boy, I didn't like it as much as you, certainly. It was, first of all, I do want to go to an Irish roast beef and whiskey bar. Please open one in my area. It was fun to see them out. I liked the change of scenery and the change of set. And I love Lorraine's disco hair. It will always be one of my favorite characters. I felt like I'd seen it all before, and it didn't really add anything. They were just out there doing the bits. Oh, but there was a line. I have paid for many women worse than you. What yes. A fucking line. Oh, yeah. But the more I see them, it's just... I don't know, maybe I've just seen them too much, and maybe it's because of how we watch these shows so sequentially. Just feel like I've seen it a lot, and they're just sometimes they just do come off as scumbags, and I felt that a little strongly in this one. But oh, and I also like that they kept saying buy yourselves a drink.
Yeah,
that was really good.
It's obviously the first one that I recurring characters that I remember from other episodes that I'd seen. So I didn't know if it was the first time it was their appearance or not. But the only thing I find is it runs the risk of what all the sort of beating a dead horse characters they do on Saturday Night Live, like the Batabi brothers for Roxbury and, you know, and It's Pat and, you know, which are all great. But, you know, once you're on your fourth or fifth skit, it does get a little repetitive, but I will say I laughed a lot. I probably laughed hardest at this one than anything I'd seen on this episode so far. Yeah, the vibrator drill thing I thought was just super bizarre. And again, telling the other guys instead of just saying back off to buy themselves a drink. Very, very, very clever.
This gentleman is the last Fest Drunk Brothers we will see on Saturday Night Live until 1998.
Whoa. Well,
wow.
See you later.
They go on to make two later appearances, one with the Roxbury guys and then one in a really cool sketch, a dating game sketch.
I'm a little surprised. Well, I am surprised.
In the hot era, there were four Fest Drunks, and yet Wild and Crazy Guys is associated with the show so much. And yet, how many Stefans were there? How many cheerleaders were there? And while still... It was only four, and these guys are one of the top characters ever. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. But the especially the 90s SNL, yeah. There was no horse they would beat hard enough. Like, it was just once they caught something that caught on, I'm surprised there wasn't two skits in an episode.
Mango.
Seriously, Mango was hilarious, except that on the 27th Mango skit, it's like, eh.
We're now off to Nerd Hospital. Speaking of recurring characters, we have Garrett entering as Grant Robinson Jr., who's visiting Lisa Lupner at the hospital. Lisa is a patient because she has a deviated septum. This is back in the days when they keep you overnight for a deviated septum. He reminds her about meeting her at the science fair, which is a throwback to another Steve Martin episode. Grant is selling chocolates to support his baseball team. We then have Jane entering as Mrs. Lupner. She's only there for a second, and I think she's only there to deliver one line about Gilda having a black friend. Todd then enters, Todd played by Bill Murray, of course, sneaks up behind Lisa and does the old guess who thing. She calls out like John Travolta, and he then calls Lisa's breasts a hope chest because she keeps on hoping. We then have Steve Martin entering as Chaz the Spaz, another character from that science fair episode. He has some flowers, a card, and a Marvin Hamlisch album for Lisa. Todd, of course, can't stand Chaz, and it is made far worse by Chaz bringing Lisa her homework. Todd says that Lisa should be ashamed of herself for taking homework from two guys. Chaz then tries to break one of Todd's pencils, but he can't. Then Todd and Chaz get into a thing where they kind of tussle. They fold Lisa up in the bed, and they start piling on Gilda until Mrs. Loupner comes in. Garrett then enters as a female nurse who is Grant's mother. And this might be the first time we have two on-screen appearances by one actor in two different roles in one sketch. Also, Garrett playing drag twice in one episode and playing his own mother, which is something I think has only been done by Lorraine thus far on the show, playing a character and the character's mother when she does Amy and Rosalind Carter. So those keeping trivia notes, there you go. Mrs. Loupner kicks them out. And then in a nice little moment, Gilda as Lisa, who shows she's a little worried, goes over, grabs her teddy bear and goes to sleep. A nice, sweet ending, I suppose. These sketches are so hard to summarize because the dialogue and the activity and the just tomfoolery is so fast paced. There's also seems to be a lot of ad-libbiness going on here, but the strength of these sketches are the developed characters, the almost ongoing serialized plot in a way, and the energy and chemistry between Bill and Gilda, and certainly Steve and Garrett held their own there as well. I thought this was a really good sketch.
My note is literally the exact same. Great chemistry, like Bill Murray and Gilda Radner. There's an electricity between the two of them. Like, you can tell how fond they were of each other and how they love to play and act with each other. It's really, really, really cool to watch. I laughed quite a bit at the whole skit. Garrett in drag for the second time in an episode was crazy. I thought it was awesome. And I really liked the denouement ending, like just the slow burn, relaxed ending was unexpected to me. So yeah, I really liked this skit quite a bit.
I know this one wasn't so much for me, I'm afraid. I did think Garrett was pretty good as a nerdy teen, but I just don't like these characters very much. I find them really obnoxious, and they always drop the same jokes and use the same bits, and I'm tired of it. I didn't think Steve Martin added anything to the bit. And while I, you know, smirked at the physical comedy at the end, it was cute when Jane came back and they were all like, "Hi, Mrs. Loupner." For the most part, I'm like, it feels like a rerun.
Yeah. Again, it's the risk you take, I guess, when you have recurring characters.
Yeah. I just think that they beat them too hard.
Yeah. We've seen a lot of these guys the last season or last half season or so.
And listen, it's fine to run the same characters, you know, beat your characters into the ground, but write some different shit for them.
We're now off to Looks at Books. Jane is back hosting Looks at Books with Bob Crawford, played by Dan, who writes a book called Mauled, where he says he wants to warn people about feeding marshmallows to grizzly bears. The right side of Dan's face is completely scarred up. His eye is closed. I think we're supposed to assume it's missing. And his top lip is gone. Dan gives a bunch of reasons as to why people shouldn't feed bears at national parks, especially doing sort of a mouth-to-mouth marshmallow grab. When asked if he's going to write any more books, Dan says he hopes not. This was a very quick sketch.
I liked it. It was, I think it was just there for the shock value. When they revealed his face, I was even looking at it, and I said out loud, "Oh my God." The crowd gasped, and that's all it was about. And, but I did think it was really funny that Jane didn't read the book despite hosting books. But it was all in just getting a good gasp out of seeing his face, I think, and having this. This is actually, it's pretty dark to have a physically deformed man who wrote a book called Mauled and have him be an absolute ass on TV. Anyway, I liked it. It needed to be short, and it was. They knew what they were doing.
I feel bad about this one because I just literally wrote meh.
Yeah.
It just didn't connect with me. I don't know. I liked that it was short. I liked the makeup. I thought the sort of the visual effect of his face, I thought was interesting, but again, just didn't laugh.
I guarantee right now in 2023, the movie rights for Mauled would be sold for like millions of dollars.
Absolutely.
Now off to Van Morrison again. This time he's singing Kingdom Hall. Kingdom Hall was the lead track from Wavelength. I couldn't see offhand if it was released as a single. Sort of cut and paste my answer from the first one, with the only difference that this one was certainly a lot more like Brown Eyed Girl than the first song was. But again, the full band energy is great. And I thought this was another solid performance from Van Morrison.
I agree completely. Like, it was up-tempo, it was catchy, you know, it was fine. And I do think his band is great. Sometimes I like getting yelled at, so.
The songs are okay, but like, maybe if Lindsey Buckingham was singing them, I'm in. I hate Van Morrison's voice. I hate his stage presence. Yeah, I find him hideous to look at. aesthetically unpleasant. And he's rambly and yelly, and it keeps it off the menu for me.
Van Morrison does look like every baseball coach, every nasty dad that we grew up around, you know?
Yeah, looks like the Irish drunk stereotype.
Very cantankerous.
Now we're off to the restaurant. Steve and Gilder are at a restaurant after a show. And they're talking about the show. Dan enters as a waiter who is a big fan of theirs and says he's kept the restaurant open for them. Dan slips away Steve and Gilda talk about how close they've gotten. And Steve says his girlfriend is sick and Gilda is the only girl that his girlfriend is okay with him dating. Dan keeps coming out and interrupting Steve and Gilda with their own catchphrases. When he's asked to stop and leave them in peace, Dan wonders why these two went into show business if they didn't want people coming up to them and interrupting them with their catchphrases. Dan and Steve get into a bit of a scuffle and the sketch abruptly ends. It seems like they've ran out of time. That's what I've been able to read online. At the Good Night, Steve says they'll finish the sketch when he comes back in February. He blames it on technical issues, which is possible because there were some weird chyrons popping up at weird times tonight. Steve, of course, doesn't come back in February, and the sketch is going to linger in limbo for the rest of time. I thought the sketch was fine. It looks like it's going somewhere. It's definitely hurt by its abrupt ending. It's also hurt, and this is, we can't help it, it's 2023, we're looking back. It's really hurt by the amount of time that this sort of shtick has been done ever since. It's a lot of places. Anytime there's like a show about a celebrity, that, you know, a scripted show about a celebrity. I mean, Extras was based on this whole premise. You know, there's the Father Ted thing with Rick Wilson. You know, it's a lot of places. I can't help that the first time might not have been the first time I saw it. Not being able to finish because they run out of time is not good.
That's really interesting. I thought that was on purpose. I will say I thought maybe that was part of the joke that it just sort of stopped. I didn't take it seriously, but now that you mentioned it, you're probably correct. I thought it was okay. I thought the whole talk about the terminal illness just sat really weird with me, knowing what ends up happening to Gilda Radner, and it just seemed that just left a little bit of ick. And it's not the fault of the sketch at all, obviously, but no. In the hindsight, I found it very sad.
Yeah, Dan was great. I loved him as the obnoxious fan, and we couldn't stop doing the lines. It did seem abrupt to me when it ended. I would have liked it to have a nice conclusion. I'm sorry it never happens, and then it's lost in the ethers of time. What a pity. I did think it was pretty good.
Yeah, it's a shame it didn't get to end. So the Good Knights, Steve and Gilder are still sitting at the table in the restaurant. Some folks are gathered around. Steve explains the bit about the technical issue and he'll be back in February. He does not come back in February. Almost everyone's there. I noticed Belushi's there chatting with Van Morrison. Garrett and Jane are sort of arm in arm, but Bill and Dan are nowhere to be seen. It was an interesting Good Nights. It was very subdued. I think some people might have been pissed off they didn't get to finish the sketch. What anything jump out at those Good Nights?
Other than that, it was just, I've never seen a Good Night that actually genuinely carried on from the last sketch. I thought that was interesting, but yeah, nothing else seemed extraordinary to me.
Yeah, me either. I didn't notice. I didn't even notice those dudes missing.
I just keep my eye out, because remember in the early episodes, Matt, Dan Aykroyd would just boot it off stage once, like, he was, his contractual obligation to be there to wave goodbye was done. He was gone, right?
Yeah, that was weird, even though, you know, I did relate, like, okay, am I done? Okay, I got to go.
So let's rate the host. Steve Martin has been up and down for us throughout. I thought lately there's been way more ups than downs. This was another definite up. I thought Martin elevated the sketches he was in and was probably given some things that other people couldn't have done. Certainly the reliance on the recurring characters may have helped, may have hurt. I thought it helped. And he did try a few new things. The monologue, a bit longer than I'd like, but quite good as well. But he didn't have a sort of, you know, when you think of the last Steve Martin episode, and that's a hard one to compare to because it was pretty close to the perfect episode. This time around, not so much. Just kind of staying the course, I guess. But all things considered, I really enjoyed Steve Martin tonight.
I agree. Just the air of professionalism that I really like. And again, back to the doesn't read the cue cards. He genuinely seems to know what he's doing. Seems very comfortable. And I think there's only one skit that he's not in, the looks at books. That's a pretty hefty night, Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, you can't deny the talent, but there's also something that's just not popping with me. Right, he was in every sketch. It was like a total workhorse. But did you not notice there was no real pizzazz?
So the music, I really enjoyed the energy of the music. Like I said, I find Van Morrison hard to understand. I really thought he was very good, but his band, especially his backup singers, were great. The energy was there. And I did think that the music we heard tonight was at least stylistically, it fit in with the show. It was upbeat. It was kind of fun stuff. I doubt I'm going to put this ever in my top five, but I did enjoy Van Morrison tonight.
Yeah, he's not my favorite either, but if you're judging on the two songs and the two performances tonight, I thought he was perfectly good. I thought he was actually maybe a little bit better than good. Minimalist sort of presentation, nothing super fancy, but the band was awesome, and I liked both the songs, so no complaints from me. I was a little skeptical when I saw that Van Morrison was the musical guest tonight, because again, I'm not a huge fan, but I think he done good.
Excellent.
I'm not converted. The songs did seem good, but again, I hate his voice. I don't want to listen. And this is and I like obnoxious voices. I like Rush and Smashing Pumpkins, so it's not like I'm put off by unique voices, but yeah, this one doesn't do it for me.
So, fellas, what was the worst sketch of the night?
I'm gonna be so unpopular here. I had my worst sketch of the night, the one I'd like the least, was What If.
My least favorite was the Loupner sketch. I just found it overdone, and I was really tired of the same bits, and I didn't think Steve Martin added anything to it. I just, same old shit for me.
We're going three different ways tonight, fellas. For me, it was the sketch at the end. I don't know. I just couldn't get past the time or technical issues that ruined it. And again, this joke, I know it's not their fault being in 1978, but I've seen this a lot afterwards. There was some fun, though, seeing Dan do the catchphrases and the reactions to them. But just it was hampered to me by it being cut off. Not their fault, but it happened. So the best sketch of the night.
Mine's a little bit of a cheat, because to me, the one thing that stood out more than anything else in the whole episode was Elvis Presley's coat.
Yeah.
Like, that's something I'm going to rewatch. I love the current digital shorts. I love when they really hit one of these well, I love it. And I could rewatch it again and again.
It was actually mine, too. It got my biggest laugh of the episode when I saw the coat boogieing with the lay and thinking about how, you know, this is a grim reality. And, you know, eventually we'll just have digital celebrities at meet and greets. And I don't know, made my mind spin out while laughing at the same time.
Definitely on my list. There was a lot on my list tonight, though, but I went with Theodoric by a Nose. It's not what the first one was, but again, the first one was my favorite season 3 sketch. With these sketches, they go all out with the props, the set, the costumes, and I think some research really goes into this one. Performances are excellent, sketch is funny and intelligent. And who was your star of the night, gang?
I would go between Bill Murray and Gilda Radner. If I were to gun to my head, I would probably pick Gilda. I thought she was very, very appealing, as always. She's just a superstar.
This is tough for me. No one really super stood out for me. But I really thought the performance of the night was Garrett on Weekend Update. And yeah, he was also really good in the nerd sketch. So I'm going to give it to him.
I thought Jane stood out so much tonight. She was too good and too much for me. Her Eleanor Roosevelt, Mrs. Loupner, she killed it on Update for me. Standard looks at books, the irate mother in Theodoric, the random woman in the Festrunks. I thought she was just amazing. And Eleanor Roosevelt, for me, was one of the biggest laughs I've gotten thus far through these rewatches. If I had to encapsulate an episode for me so far that demonstrates the abilities of Jane Curtin, it is this one. So overall, this was a really, really strong episode. We had a very good, poignant, and appropriate opening. Festrunks were good. Theodoric was good. The Nerds was good. A lot of throwbacks. What If was good. Elvis's coat was good. Update was good. And then even at the end, that's a half-decent idea that didn't get finished. That might be the only thing that really hurt the show for me in any way. Van Morrison's bits were strong, and it complemented the show well. Again, it's just one of these things. I miss the whimsy of a performance that could only, you don't get to see them too often, but a performance that could only be done on SNL, where this looks like it's Van Morrison here and it would be Van Morrison everywhere. All things considered, guys, I was extremely, extremely happy with this episode, and I gave this a 9 out of 10.
I would agree with most of what you're saying. There was a couple of weak spots for me, but overall, I could watch the whole episode again right away if I had to, or want, or if I had the chance, and I would give it a pretty solid 8.
Excellent.
I liked the cold open, so I remember that fondly. I did think the monologue was too long. We got a good coat sketch. And the Eleanor Roosevelt sketch didn't hit with me, but I really liked the green screen. I definitely didn't like it as much as you guys. I did not like the music. The Fest Drunk Brothers and the Nerds were too recurring for me. The looks at books was just a quick little shock laugh. Yeah, Dan's impressions were okay. It was very serviceable and very good, but I didn't think it was a classic or anything. I'll go 6.5.
Okay, so with my 9, Harris's 8, and Matt's 6.5 gives it a 7.8. The Internet Movie Database gave it a 7.9, so we're significantly closer than we usually are. The episode's ranking for the year it's the second best of the year. Thought it was a pretty fun episode all around, and we're not going to see Steve Martin again this season,
which is, I don't think you need double hosts in a season, like, unless like you're a big network TV show. I'm sure you're not desperate. Spread your wings.
We do still have some double hosts this year, but Steve Martin isn't one of them. So, Harris, thank you so much for joining us for the first time. We do have you scheduled to come back at least once during our season 4 coverage. I hope you'll still be interested in joining us.
I had the best time. I would do this every week.
Oh, that's awesome. Great to hear. So thanks so much, Harris. We'll see you again towards the end of season 4 for another episode. Matt, do you know who the host and musical guest are next week?
No, lay it on me.
I am really excited to get your reaction to this. Our host is Buck Henry.
Cool. Been a bit. I'm ready.
Okay. And the musical guest is the Grateful Dead.
That's interesting. I'm interested.
I know you're not a Deadhead, but are you a Grateful Dead fan?
I mean, they got some good stuff, but yeah. I'm certainly not a Deadhead. I don't enjoy the 26-minute noodlings of Jerry Garcia, but they definitely have some good songs.
So thank you all for joining us. You can find us, of course, on Twitter at SNHell1. We're available over at wherever your podcasts are found. We're hosted at Podbean, but we go out everywhere with that. Please like, subscribe, comment if you're so inclined. We've got some great commenters who've been kind of following us for a while now, throwing some stuff in. Even love the guys who are Broderick Crawford fans who want Matt and I to kill ourselves. So Matt and I will be back in about a week, but until then, we'll be scaring foxes with our enormous bulges here in SN Hell.